There are lots of people now who are horrified at Israel's retaliatory action after October 7th. And they say things like, well, if 1,000 people were killed on October 7th and 250 taken hostage, Israel should limit its retaliation to some kind of proportionality to what happened in the original attack. I would say to such a person, all right, Japan in World War II struck at Pearl Harbor, killed, it was mainly a military target, but there were some civilians killed, let's say 2,000. Are you saying that the United States should not have declared war on Japan, but should have conducted some bombing raids and kept a relative count of the number of people bombed and then kind of stop at about 2,000, maybe 4,000, but don't go too far? Instead, the United States goes to war in the Pacific. And even though there's controversy about the atomic bombs, the alternative to the atomic bomb was a massive land invasion of Japan that would have produced countless casualties, both military and civilian. And I'm not aware of any serious criticism of that.
Hi, I've got with us today Dinesh D'Souza. He's a friend of mine. We've known each other for several years. And Dinesh is coming out with a new movie called The Dragon's Prophecy. Dinesh is a political commentator. He's an author, Christian apologist, defender of the faith, and a filmmaker. As far as his books, he's written about a dozen books, several of them New York Times bestsellers. And I'll tell you, Dinesh, I watched that movie 4 times. And the music, the background music that you have, the artwork, the animation, the inserted videos, the interviews, I learned a lot, and it's extremely well done. In the past, I've not always been excited about videos made by people who love the Lord, because sometimes they're compromised. But you really, really did a great job.
Well, that really means a lot. This is, I think, my 8th or 9th documentary, so I like to think I've learned a few things along the way. It's also a departure from me in terms of subject matter. My earlier films, in one way or another, have all been about the meaning of America. But this film not only takes in a much wider geographical landscape, the Middle East, larger orbit of radical Islam, but it is also an attempt to integrate the political with the moral, the spiritual, the biblical. There is a section on biblical archaeology. There's a hint of biblical prophecy. So these are topics I have not really navigated, at least not in my films, before. And ironically, I set out to make a film that was timeless, and yet it's turned out to be extremely timely.
Yes, it's extremely timely. In fact, you have current events, things that have even happened in the last 30 or 60 days. I mean, it's really amazing how current it is. And let me start by asking a question. Why should Christian Americans care about Israel? Why should we even care?
I would say that we should care about Israel for two distinct and separate reasons. Either of these reasons would be sufficient by itself, but put together, they make a powerful case. So the first reason is simply that Israel is a needed ally in a very dangerous part of the world where jihadi schemes are being cooked up, not just for the region, but for the planet. In other words, when you think about this movement of global Islamic jihad, it comes out of the desert fumes of Arabia. You've got people in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Pakistan, in Turkey. These are not people who care particularly about Palestine. Palestine, Gaza, the Judea, Samaria, that is a small part of their of what their covetous eye sort of descends on. But these are people who want to take over the region. They want to establish a caliphate. They are infiltrating places like Australia, Canada, Europe, the United States. I live in Texas. We see these sort of jihadi operations conducted in Houston and Dallas. They run for the school board. They talk about establishing distinctive Islamic communities. There's even talk of Sharia. So it's important for Americans to know that this isn't just something that's happening over there. And yet Israel is on the front lines fighting this global jihad. And Israel is doing it with a aplomb, a sophistication, putting its own people at risk. And this is a fight that they know how to fight, and we don't. And by that, I mean, look at our miserable track record, right? A generation ago, Jimmy Carter withdrew American support for the Shah of Iran. And when he did that, we got Khomeini. So the United States played a small role, but a complicit role in helping radical Islam get a hold of a major state. Fast forward a little bit, after 9/11, the United States went over to Afghanistan, kind of pulverized the Taliban, ejected them, but guess what? They're back. So they won that battle long term. And then, of course, I don't even have to go into the Iraq mess. So the United States has a very checkered, poor record of fighting radical Islam. And Israel knows how to do it. They can take on the jihadis in Yemen, in Sudan, in Qatar, in Iran. And little Israel is capable on its own of fighting that battle. Now, yes, they called on Donald Trump to supply the B-2s and a couple of fighter planes to disable the Iranian nuclear facilities. But hey, that was good for Israel. I would argue it's just as good for the United States. So this is not a case where we were sacrificing our interests to Israel. We gained just as much and at a very low cost, right? We basically, it's a 48-hour loan of our planes and with a handful of bombs. So that's reason number one. It's you could call it the political reason, the realpolitik reason, the reason in why it's in our interest. The second reason is more subtle, but I think no less powerful. And that is our entire civilization, Western civilization, and America. The American founders did not come to this country empty-handed. They brought with them, loosely speaking, Athens and Jerusalem. Now, Athens represents classical reason. It represents the Greek theater, Pericles and the founding of democracy. So that's one element of the West. But the West would not be the West with Athens alone. Then there's Jerusalem. And Jerusalem refers to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It refers to the Ten Commandments. It refers to the Hebrew prophets. It refers to the Messiah, Jesus, who was not only a Jew, but taught out of the Old Testament, preached in synagogues, ate Jewish food, kept the Jewish holidays, bathed in the Pool of Siloam, and walked up the pilgrimage road to the temple built originally by Solomon and then reconstructed by Herod. So here's what I'm getting at. If you were to remove one of those two pillars of Western civilization, the whole thing would collapse. We need Athens and we also need Jerusalem. And so the second reason for our connection is moral, it's spiritual, it is one of the building blocks of our civilization. And without it, we would not be the strong and prosperous country that we are.
So following on your first rationale, would we then say that Israel's enemies are probably our enemies as well, because this saying that they are the little Satan and we are the big Satan?
I think that is generally true. In other words, I think that to the degree that Israel is fighting the global jihadis, well, the jihadis understand perfectly well, just as you said, that they see Israel as a kind of surrogate of the United States. They in no way think that if they were to win in Israel that they are done, that they can then pack up and go home. They're just getting started. In fact, taking over Israel would whet their appetite for much more ambitious goals beyond that. Just like the armies of Islam that came out of the Arabian desert in the 7th century. They were extremely excited to conquer Mecca and Medina. Did they stop? No, they then targeted the Holy Land. And in fact, at the time of Jesus, everything that we call the Middle East was in Christian hands. Jerusalem, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, all of this was Christian territory. It was overrun by the Muslims who colonized it. I mean, isn't it interesting that we keep hearing about Israel, the colonizer, but Islam was the great colonizer of that region. And then, of course, Islamic armies didn't stop there. They went north into Europe, they went east into India, they went south into Africa. So Israel's enemies in this case do turn out to be our enemies as well.
If you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, send me an email, tour@drjamestour.org, and we will get together and I will share with you about why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus. Okay, and then following on your second rationale as to why Christian Americans would be interested, and I will say that, you know, if you love the Bible, you're going to love this movie because it is just bathed in scripture verses, but also in the sense that, as you said, the Messiah, the word of God came out of Israel. These people guarded it, protected it, and bled and died to protect the word of God. And then the Messiah was born in Israel to Mary, a Jewish mother, Yeshua being Jesus's name, which is a Jewish name. And as you point out in the movie, I mean, even when he turned over the tables in that was in the temple. Where was this temple? Was it in Tibet? Was it in Singapore? No, it was right there in Jerusalem. And the Messiah came out of there. And then also all the writers of the scriptures, these were Jews, even of the New Testament. These were all Jews. It wasn't until Acts chapter 9 that Cornelius, the first Gentile, comes in. So we are intertwined dramatically in the early stages with the Jewish people.
Yeah, the Western civilization has a Judeo-Christian tradition. Now, there are people who say, what is this word Judeo-Christian? It is an invented word. It doesn't really refer to anything concrete or specific or historical. And I'll take a moment to demonstrate why that's false. There are people who have the erroneous view that somehow churches had their origins in the 3rd or the 4th century, sometime perhaps around the time of Constantine. The Christians started building churches, but there were really no churches before that. But this is actually not true. The very early Christians in Jerusalem and elsewhere met in synagogues. And so now archaeology is finding these ruins of these synagogues, and yet they notice that the synagogues don't face the temple. They actually face the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Think about this. This means that the early Christians did oriented their Jewish buildings, but to the spot that they believe to be the site of the crucifixion. Not to mention that they now see all these Christian markings and even Christian graffiti, at least first century graffiti, in these synagogues. And so it's quite obvious that these people were in fact the original Judeo-Christians. They were Jews who followed the Messiah. There wasn't any kind of formal Christianity then, but they could accurately be described as Judeo-Christian.
Yes. And full disclosure, I'm a Messianic Jew, which means that I'm a Jew by origin, but I've come to know Jesus as my Messiah at the age of 18. And I have family living in Israel. My daughter has worked with Palestinians for many years, she being a Messianic Jew, working and having many friends that were Palestinians. So you know, at one point in the movie, you said the civilian deaths on both sides is the thing that disturbs you most and is the currency of the dragon. What did you mean by that?
So the dragon, well, the dragon in the title of the film is The Dragon's Prophecy, refers to a passage in the book of Revelation where a dragon representing the devil, Satan, is at war with a woman representing Israel, and the woman is pregnant. And the pregnancy represents the Messiah, the fruit of Israel.
And a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child, and she crieth out, travailing in birth and in pain to be delivered. And there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head 7 diadems. And his tail draweth the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. and the dragon standeth before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered he may devour her child. And she was delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and unto his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that there they may nourish her 1,260 days.
The meaning of this passage, this mystery, I think, is this, that there is a world behind the world, and that there is a eternal battle that is going on. It's been going on from the time there was a rebellion in heaven at the very beginning of time between God and the devil. In fact, the name Satan in that sense means opposer. Satan is opposed to the ways of God. Now, Satan cannot defeat God, but because of that, Satan has to develop a different strategy. And so what Satan does is he picks on the things that God cares about, that are important to God, and his strategy is, I want to ruin those things. So why does Satan, for example, why does the serpent target Adam and Eve in the garden, Genesis 1? Well, the answer is simple. I mean, Adam and Eve haven't done anything to the serpent, but the serpent wants to ruin God's cherished creation and thereby get revenge, thereby get the last laugh on God.
And the dragon waxed wroth with the woman, and went away to make war with the rest of her seed, that keep the commandments of God, and hold the testimony of Jesus. Revelation 12:17.
I think for the same reason, Satan targets the Jews. If the Jews are the people of God, if Jews are the chosen ones, then Satan goes, all right, I'm going to drive them out of their homeland from the river to the sea. And not only that, I'm going to take their holiest site, the temple, the Solomonic temple, and I'm going to put on it an Islamic victory arch called the Dome of the Rock, and adjoining it a mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's almost as if Satan himself has descended and occupied, sitting on top of the holiest site in Judaism and also in Christianity.
Okay, that story that you referred to in the book of Revelation, the woman has this child, but then there's also other children. Who are they?
The other children are the, you could say, the spiritual descendants of the Israelites. And if the Israelites are the Jews, then the spiritual descendants are the Christians, the people who have been engrafted onto the old covenant in much the same way that the New Testament is engrafted on the old one. So this is not a case of some kind of new religion developing that is radically opposed to the old. We're getting some of that rhetoric right now, as if Christianity emerged in opposition to Judaism, the New Testament in opposition to the old. In some ways, the second and third person of the Trinity in opposition to the first person of the Trinity. And all of this, I think, is just absolutely not just unbiblical, but anti-biblical. There's a reason that the Old Testament is in the Bible, and that is because I think I remember learning this many, many years ago. The New Testament is in the Old concealed. The Old Testament is in the New revealed. And I think that this shows the inextricable connection between the Old Testament and the New. So we, the Christians, are the spiritual Israelites. And so, and here we're not just talking in a metaphorical way. I mean, it's very obvious that the forces of evil today are targeting in a very concrete way, not just the Jews, but the Christians. Look at the way, for example, that radical Islam targets Christians in Nigeria. There have been multiple attacks on churches, beheadings. This is going on with not a lot of media attention. And so not only are the Christians and Jews, the Israelites and the spiritual Israelites being attacked together, they're being attacked by the same people. And when I say the same people, I mean the radical jihadis, yes, but I'm also talking about the cultural left in the West, which is just as unhappy with Israel as it is with Christianity in its own societies.
Yeah, and getting back to the scriptural relation, because there's many parallels that your movie makes between what the scriptures say and what's going on in current events. You know, it's always dangerous to say this is the fulfillment of the biblical prophecy, but you're careful about that because you're just showing the it's certainly there are parallels there. So if this dragon is attacking the woman because it's unable to attack the child, the Messiah, if the dragon is attacking the woman, the dragon is also going after the other children as well, and that's the demonic attack, the satanic attack upon the Christians as well. Correct?
Yes, I think the unique contribution of Jonathan Cahn to this film. He wrote the book, the international bestseller called The Dragon's Prophecy, and the film is named after him. Now, there's some material in the film, biblical archaeology and so on, that goes beyond the book, but the book itself has, I think, a very interesting insight. Jonathan Cahn argues that the battle between Israel and Hamas is a kind of strange recreation. He calls it a resurrection. The way Cahn puts it is he says, Israel is a resurrected nation because the Jews being scattered to the ends of the earth came back. They've been resurrected in that quite direct way. He says, what if the enemy, what if the devil, what if the dragon, in imitation, in perverse imitation of the ways of God, goes, I'm going to resurrect one of the ancient enemies of Israel. Not in a genetic sense, but rather I'm going to bring back is the longtime enemy of the biblical Israelites, namely the Philistines. Now, Philistine and Palestine is not only a similar sounding word, it's the same name. But Cahn goes on to say it's not just a matter of the same name, it's also a matter of the same tactics.
And the Philistines laid hold on him and put out his eyes. And they brought him down to Gaza and bound him with fetters of brass. And he did grind in the prison house. Judges 16:21.
So if you consider a figure like Samson in the Bible, Samson who represents the strength of Israel, Samson is captured by who? Well, by the Philistines. And they blind him. They blind him in much the same way that Israel was blinded on October 7th. And then they drag him, the Bible says, to Gaza. So Gaza is mentioned in the Bible. And it says the people of Gaza came out and said, bring us Samson so that he might entertain us.
And it came to pass, when their hearts were merry, that they said, call for Samson, that he may make us sport. And they called for Samson out of the prison house, and he made sport before them. Judges 16:25.
And sure enough, after October 7th, captives, hostages were stripped. They were paraded in Gaza, and people are celebrating, cheering, Allahu Akbar. And so Cahn makes, I think, the arresting observation that Samson was the first hostage of Gaza. So all of this, I think, is a way of offering a larger meaning to October 7th. October 7th isn't just another terrorist attack. It's not just even another historical event. It is an event of biblical dimensions. And this is the way in which the film integrates the political with the biblical.
Okay. The movie spends a fair amount of time looking at archaeology. You know, there was the higher criticism of the New Testament, of the Gospels, that this was made up, this couldn't be real. And then in defense, they started doing this biblical archaeology and looking at the things in the Gospels, looking at the things also in the Old Testament. So pull this together for me. How does this somehow speak against this idea of colonialism where Israel is just came in 1948? That's not really they were never there in the long term.
Well, if the Jews are the original inhabitants of the region, then it makes no sense to call them colonizers, right? The Native Americans can't colonize the Americas. The Irish can't colonize Ireland. The Indians can't colonize India because they were there from the beginning. They were the original inhabitants of the region, or the Aboriginal inhabitants, if you want to put it that way. The Jonathan Kahn, in his analysis, focuses on a biblical perspective, but I have an audience that to some degree is secular, and there are people who are going to say, well, this is all very interesting, but how do you know that these figures in the Bible, Pontius Pilate in the New Testament, Isaiah, Jeremiah, the prophets, King David, how do you know that these were real people? How do you know that the Bible is talking about true events? And this is where archaeology settles the issue. And the beauty of it is that in a very secular age, it appears like God himself is speaking back, but now not speaking in the grandiose language of revelation. He's not speaking in the form that we find, for example, in the opening verse in the Bible. In the beginning, there was the heavens and the earth. That is a kind of declaratory language, sort of speaking from on high. But now we have a kind of whispering through the language of science itself, through archaeology. And the real power of this archaeology is that there are now truly, not dozens, hundreds of archaeological discoveries, and they all move in one direction. They support and affirm and confirm the authenticity, the historicity of both the Hebrew and the Christian scriptures. I'm not aware of a single major archaeological finding that contradicts the Bible. Now, true, there's a lot in the Bible that has not been found. People say, well, you haven't found Noah's Ark and you haven't located the Tower of Babel. And it's true. There are a lot of things in the Bible that have no external archaeological confirmation. But that simply may mean that there are things that are waiting future discovery. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So I put the archaeological section in, not just because I think it has the exhilarating effect of ratifying, authenticating the Bible, but also because it, beyond a doubt, establishes the Jews as the original inhabitants. By the way, the Palestinians, so-called, are not the original inhabitants of Gaza. The Philistines are, and interestingly, the Philistines are not Semites, they're not Arabs. They are European peoples who came from the Mediterranean, from the Aegean. They came from places like Cyprus. So that is a population that appears to have either been dispersed or died out. So you have this great irony that the Palestinians, who are not native to Gaza, claim to be original inhabitants and accuse the Jews, who are the original inhabitants of the region, of being colonizers.
I have a lot of Palestinian friends. Over the years, I've had many, many dear, dear friends, and I find them to be actually extremely nice and kind to me, and so I have many of them. But I want to follow up on something that you said. You said you were contrasting anti-Semitism with racism, and you went on to say that you know you critique anti-Semitism in this way. He says it's fine to criticize people, you said, and it's fine to criticize even the Jews. But do you criticize the Jews for something that you do not criticize any other people group for? So tell me what you mean by that.
Well, anti-Semitism these days, when you raise the term, people will say, well, you're just saying that because you want to shut down debate and you are trying to prevent me from making legitimate criticisms of Israel or even of the Jews. And I say, no, I'm not trying to prevent you from doing that. But if you have a compass, a moral standard that you apply pretty much even-handedly in the world, but then that standard goes away, or you want a different standard when it comes to the Jews or to Israel, then I have reasonable grounds to suspect your motives. So to take an example, there are lots of people now who are horrified at Israel's retaliatory action after October 7th. And they say things like, well, if 1,000 people were killed on October 7th and 250 taken hostage, Israel should limit its retaliation to some kind of proportionality to what happened in the original attack. And then I would say to such a person, all right, well, Japan in World War II struck at Pearl Harbor, killed, it was mainly a military target, but there were some civilians killed, let's say 2,000. Are you saying that the United States should not have declared war on Japan, but should have conducted some bombing raids and kept a relative count of the number of people bombed, and then kind of stop at about 2,000, maybe 4,000, but don't go too far? Instead, the United States goes to war in the Pacific. And even though there's controversy about the atomic bombs, the alternative to the atomic bomb was a massive land invasion of Japan that would have produced countless casualties, both military and civilian. And I'm not aware of any serious criticism of that. There's criticism of the atomic bombs, but even the people who don't like that say, well, we should have done the land invasion instead. Also, after 9/11, the United States went over to Afghanistan and did essentially carpet bombing of Kabul. Massive bombs are dropped on the place. We can't even count. We've never bothered to count the number of actual casualties. And so what I'm getting at is, if people are okay with all that and adopt the logic, well, you started it, so we get to finish it. And yet, when it comes to October 7th, that standard, that compass, that logic disappears, and a new one is put in its place, I go, I smell a rat.
Because of you, millions of people have heard the gospel.
If you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that he's risen from the dead, and you will be saved.
That's right.
That's the requirement.
We talk about science concepts which draw people in.
Take these nanomachines and have them drill into cells.
This would be a great way to kill cancer, right?
We also talk about Jesus Christ, who's the best in everything.
My faith in Jesus Christ means more to me than anything.
If you could continue to give or give for the first time, we would certainly appreciate it. You can go to jesusandscience.org/donate. All U.S. donations are tax deductible. Thank you so much.
You know, I saw a tweet, a post by you recently. Somebody had pointed out, well, you know, it's the Jews that killed Jesus. And your reply was, yes, and it was the Romans that killed Caesar. Tell me something about that.
It's very interesting that in the case of Jesus, and this is almost applying the same compass we've just been talking about again, there are numerous cases in history where a particular act occurs, and yet no one would draw the conclusion that they are drawing in the Jewish case. No one would say, for example, America killed Abraham Lincoln. That would make no sense. Americans killed Abraham Lincoln. Yeah, it was in fact a conspiracy of Americans who did that. But on the other hand, there were lots of people on the other side. There was certainly no unanimity that Americans want to get rid of Abraham Lincoln and conspired together to do it. So the point I'm getting at is, in the case of Jesus, there was a cabal of high priests, including, of course, Caiaphas, the high priest. I think Annas, who was related from the same family, might have been involved. The Sanhedrin, or the ruling council, and they viewed Jesus as a political threat, perhaps a threat in other ways. And so they motivated a faction, and they stirred up the crowd to turn against Jesus. But guess what? There were lots of people who were Jesus's followers and his disciples. And after his death, these are people who went abroad. Well, they went throughout the land and lands preaching the gospel. They became, in a sense, the first followers of Jesus. I thought it's interesting that even the great apostle to the Gentiles, namely Paul, when you actually read about Paul going over to Asia Minor or going through Greece, it's striking to me that he's normally going to synagogues, which means that he is preaching in Jewish precincts, typically to an audience that is made up of Jews and Gentiles both. So the point I'm getting at here is that it would make no sense to say generically that the Jews did it. The reason I use the example of Caesar is this: there was one faction led by Cassius and Brutus that killed Caesar. There was another faction led by Mark Antony and Octavian, who sought to avenge Caesar's death. death, and just like the apostles, they took up Caesar's cause. So again, if anyone were to say the Romans killed Caesar, this people would look at you like that is an idiotic thing to say, and yet they don't think it's idiotic to say in the specific context of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. You know, in this movie, you know, the vast majority of what we've just discussed comes out, and 100 times more. There's so much here. What would you like to mention about this movie? Tell us as the producer of this movie, as the writer, as the producer, you asked a series of questions. It's interesting. You pose in the beginning a series of questions, and then you go through the movie answering those very questions that you had posed. And you ask experts, you ask different people, and then you intertwine that with Scripture. What would you like to say about all of this?
Well, I would just put it this way. You know, a movie explores a theme, and it typically does it in the form of an intellectual but also an emotional journey. And a good film will appeal both to the head and to the heart. And in a really good film, you are sometimes a little hard-pressed to say what it's actually about. And when you talk about it, it doesn't do justice to the experience of the film. I mean, a really good example would be The Shawshank Redemption. If someone were to say, what is that film about? Or there's a film I particularly like. It's an Australian classic called Breaker Morant. And if somebody would ask you, what's The Shawshank Redemption about? You say, well, it's about friendship. Or, well, it's about life in prison. And, well, it's about... you know, and you feel a little silly saying those things because it is about those things, but that doesn't even come close to describing what it's like to watch the film. The film kind of leaves you a little changed at the end, and I want this film to be like that. In other words, ever since Charlie Kirk's assassination, there's been a lot of talk in this country about renewal, about a spiritual invigoration, about a kind of new spirit in the land. And I think this film fits in with that. Now, obviously, there's no way I could have planned it. I made the film because of my interest in biblical archaeology and then some of my horror at the aftermath of October 7th. But little did I know that there would become not just a longtime left-wing critique of Israel. It's a colonizer, it's doing genocide, but a powerful and surprising critique on the right associated with figures like Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, Marjorie Taylor Greene. By the way, people I know quite well. I spoke at Candace's conferences called Blexit. I've toured Australia last year with Tucker Carlson in a number of cities. So it was a little, in some ways, awkward for me, and yet I put it all in the film. I have a snippet of Tucker talking to Senator Ted Cruz. He poses a question, takes Senator Cruz back a little bit, but I take that exact same question. I pose it to Prime Minister Netanyahu. He gives a very interesting answer. So somehow, I don't even know how this has happened, but the film is coming out at a time when the themes are much more timely, much more pressing, and much more connected with the spirit of renewal than when I even undertook or was shooting this project. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree. It's extremely timely and informative. And like I said, I watched it multiple times. It's a great movie. And this is going to come out when?
So the film is in theaters for a couple of days, October 6th and October 8th. We've bought out 400 theaters around the country, and you can get tickets from the website. So the website is thedragonsprophecyfilm.com. So the dragons, plural, prophecyfilm.com. You can't get tickets at the theater. You got to buy them on the website. But then the very next day, that's Thursday, October 9th, the film is available on multiple platforms for streaming. DVDs will land in your mailbox. So you can sign up now for the streaming. You can order your DVDs. But once again, go to the website. It's thedragonsprophecyfilm.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Dinesh. It's always good to see you, my friend. and God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me today. If you could give us a like, share, or podcast review, we would appreciate it. If you have any questions, you could send them to ask@jesusandscience.org, and we'll try to answer some of those questions in an upcoming video. And if you do not believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, and you want to hear about why I believe, send me an email to tour@drjamestour.org, and we'll get together by Zoom, and I'll share with you why I embrace the resurrection of Jesus Christ.